morning and welcome to Life Matters. Ellen Fanning with you for the first half of this week. Now, did you hear on Friday there was a lively discussion with Cassie about teacher retention, how best to keep young teachers in the game. There are some really alarming statistics about the number of young people who get into the teaching profession and are very jaded very quickly and very quickly get out. We had some great insights from our listeners and on our Facebook page, and we had these calls to our listener line.
Hi there, my name is Rachel and I'm from New South Wales, and I am one of the people you're talking about. I am a fresh teacher. I graduated not last year, the year before in September, and I got a full-time position last year in July, and I took it and I taught for 6 months and I quit at the end of the 6 months, and I was a full-time permanent teacher, so I was lucky enough to be offered a permanent position because of my efforts at university. But I think people make really big presumptions about teaching. I think people think it's the big holidays and the hours, but I can tell you now that's just not the case. I was arriving at school at 7 and leaving at 5 just so I could have everything prepared for the day, and even then it wasn't enough. I had to take my work home with me every night. It was just so difficult in every way. I cannot explain it. It was so stressful. I arrived at a school which was not equipped to support a new starting out teacher. There wasn't enough mentoring. There wasn't enough support. And I completely fell out of my depth.
Hello, I'm Sarah from South Australia. I am a former high school teacher in South Australia. And I really think that the bottom line is, and it's so often not being met in my state, is treating people honourably in school, whether they be staff or students. And unfortunately, that's not always so. I agree with Stephen when he says culture and environment, hierarchy and administration are very important to the welfare of the school overall. Thank you.
My name is Erica Jolly. I live in Adelaide. Pay teachers properly. They carry out one of the most important functions, the education of the young. Treat them with respect and pay them properly.
That issue really striking a nerve. Disillusioned young teachers, those voices particularly troubling. Thank you so much for those calls. Our listener line, 02 833 1430. We really love hearing from you. This morning, we celebrate 200 years of the most marvellously spoilt little snob, Jane Austen's Emma. I suppose today we'd say she's egotistical, elegant, conceited, but very funny, sometimes unintentionally. In fact, I went to school with a girl just like her, didn't you? Remember her? Remember that one? Well, Remembering Emma is our last segment today, and just for fun, we thought we'd introduce every segment in today's program with a quote from the novel, just to demonstrate how it still pops and sparkles. So to my first guest today, the journalist Peter Grester, who spent 13 months in an Egyptian prison on trumped-up charges of supporting a terrorist organisation and broadcasting false news to undermine national security. He was released 1 year ago today. And since then, he's been on a bit of a mission to remind journalists and their public about the fundamental importance of freedom of the press and of fearlessly sceptical and objective reporting. Now, that might sound like the subject of a slightly tedious media symposium, but for Peter to be able to lay claim to those best traditions of journalism meant that he was able to resist the charges against him, something he says would have been infinitely harder had he been one of those partisan warriors we increasingly see emerging. Peter, welcome.
Thanks very much, Ellen.
1 year out.
Yeah, it's a good feeling, huh?
Yeah.
It's been an extraordinary year. It makes me feel, every day sort of feels precious after you spend that big chunk of time in a concrete box.
Yeah. So does it feel a long time ago or just the other day?
Well, a bit of both, really. You know, if I look back at what's happened over the past 12 months, it's absolutely extraordinary. You know, the people that I've met, the the speeches I've been able to deliver, the kind of contacts that I've had, and it feels completely otherworldly. And you know, there was so much that happened. Three round-the-world trips, meetings at the White House and State Department, the UN's, the Ban Ki-moon's office and so on, all sorts of fantastic opportunities. And yet it really does feel like just the other day that I walked out of that prison. It's very, still very, very present.
You have taken this this moment in the spotlight and decided to make it about freedom of the press. I have to weave in a Jane Austen quote. I was talking to you earlier. Yes. This is the challenge I've set myself, so you just have to indulge me. I've decided you're Mr. Knightley. Now, did you read Emma, Peter?
I'm afraid that I didn't. I did a lot of reading, but Emma wasn't one of them.
Right, all right. Well, Mr. Knightley is slightly older. He's a distinguished gentleman. Does that suit you?
So far, so good.
And he says, there is one thing, Emma, which a man can always do if he chooses, and that is his duty. Not by manoeuvring and finessing, but by vigour and resolution. That sounds like you.
I'd be very flattered if it does. I've always felt, and this is something that in particular in relation to last year, that doing your duty, standing up for your principles were really fundamental things. And in a way, you know, I define that with a letter that I wrote after a couple of weeks of imprisonment, and I was really struggling with what was going on in prison. Wasn't really sure why we were there, because I couldn't make any sense of the charges. There was no connection from the charges to what we'd actually done. You know, I've done plenty of stories in the past that have upset governments and thought that I might end up getting hauled in and having to explain. But the gap in this case was so wide that it really made no sense until it really struck me that this was about press freedom. And once I realised that this was about, not about anything that we'd done, but about trying to intimidate the press more broadly and coming after us because we were politically convenient. And so in that sense, I felt that I had no choice then but to stand up for those wider principles, because I felt that it wasn't me that was under attack, it was the institution of the press that was under attack. And so I really felt that I had a responsibility, a duty to perform.
You and I went to university together.
Yeah, we did. I remember that well.
You struck me as a leader, as the sort of person who would end up managing a large corner of Rupert's empire or running the ABC, maybe. How did you end up taking yourself under your own steam to conflict zones?
Look, I'm flattered that you might have thought of me as a leader. I've always felt that I was someone who was better out in the field than stuck in an office. I was always curious. I was always interested in getting out and doing the journalism rather than directing people to do the journalism for me.
Maybe you just seemed sensible and responsible.
Maybe sensible and responsible. You know, sometimes you feel there's perhaps a little, some of that's lacking out in the field among some of my colleagues.
Well, that's right, isn't there? I mean, there seems to be sort of, as you were saying to me earlier, two sorts of foreign correspondents, the ones who sort of go to the army disposal place and want to get out there amongst the action and you think, heavens, and people who are in there for the long haul.
Yeah, look, there's an awful lot of machismo amongst a lot of correspondents, you know, looking for stories to tell back in the pub about how close they came to getting shot on any particular day. But you know, I'm in it. And I think the most responsible journalists are in it because they believe in the role that we play as reporters, as witnesses to what's taking place in some of these environments. And I, you know, at a personal level, I enjoy the challenge of operating there, but that's not the reason I do it. You do it because you believe in the principle of what we do in the first place, and that's exposing these things, that's shining a light into some of these places that would otherwise go completely unnoticed and uncared about.
Before you were arrested in Egypt, what was there a moment in the field, or maybe what was the most memorable moment in the field where you sat down after a hairy experience and thought, now hang on, why am I here?
Yeah, look, there have been quite a few of those, I guess, over the
years. Can you think of one?
Well, yeah, you know, I remember there was one occasion in Afghanistan. This was back in 1995, long before anybody really gave a toss about the country. You know, it was just another little backwater, nasty little civil war back in those days. And we were driving down a road and, you know, looking for a front line. The government said that they'd taken a particular military post, and we didn't really believe them because it just seemed too improbable under the circumstances. And we went down to see what was really going on. And sure enough, they hadn't taken the post, and we found ourselves on a front line about 3 kilometres before where the government had claimed it would be, and all of a sudden found ourselves under shell fire from a bunch of tanks up the road. And I remember huddling under in a culvert with a few other fighters, wondering why on earth I was busy doing this when they were lobbing artillery shells on top of us. But, you know, again, Afghanistan's a really good example. Back in 1995, I remember, in fact, 1994, when I applied for that job, saying to the BBC that back then that Afghanistan was the world's two biggest suppliers of the things that worried the West the most, and one was Islamic extremists and the other was narcotics, and that we need, even if we didn't care about it, it was a place that we needed to take to care about because it was going to jump up and bite us on the backside. And sure enough, 6 years later, it did.
Hmm. And so what did you tell yourself when you crawled out from under the tank about why you were going to stay?
Just that because we were the only reporters that were there at the time and that we needed to be there. One of the things that's often struck me in a lot of these places is just how grateful some of the people are to have us there, because I've often worried that the work that we do would be intrusive. You know, when you shove a microphone under someone who's grieving for the loss of a relative, that can be pretty confronting for both the person on the receiving end of the questions and the reporter themselves. But more often than not, in those sort of circumstances, I've found that people are grateful for the attention. They're grateful for the fact that the world, or someone who represents the worldview, is focusing their eyes, is looking at them, is watching, is listening to them, is you know, caring about their story. And in a funny way, that can sometimes apply meaning to it. And, you know, I've always felt that there is a role, and if you're not wanted, then it's probably for a very good reason, because someone wants to try and hide something. And that in itself is also a very good reason for being there.
You said someone had to be there, that the story needed to be told, but why you? What? I mean, I noticed that halfway through this experience, you discovered you had Latvian citizenship. So you have this interesting family background in that Dad escaped from Latvia at the age of 8 in 1944. I mean, so you had a bigger worldview than just the Brisbane boy you might have presented as. But what is it about you that meant you'd go, all right, I'll be a stringer in some of the most dangerous places on earth?
Well, it's curiosity, isn't it? I mean, that's the fundamental.
I'm not that curious.
well, I am. I mean, you know, I, Ellen, the world is a fascinating place, and I, there are three big reasons why I do it. One is curiosity. I'm just interested in this stuff. I like to find out about it. I like to, and journalism is the ultimate excuse to go and indulge a curiosity. The second is a sense of adventure. You know, you can't do it unless you like those kinds of challenges of both operating, the physical challenge of operating in a difficult space, and also the intellectual challenge that goes with that. And the third is the principle of it. As I said, it's, you know, I still believe in what we do. I still believe that it's more important that we tell these stories than not. And you know, if you add the other two bits to it, then it makes sense to go and cover some of these stories.
When you were asked by Al Jazeera to go to Cairo, I think you were relieving over the Christmas period, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
How did that assignment compare to some of the frontline work you'd done?
It was dramatic and interesting, in as much as there was an ongoing political crisis in Egypt. It was still recovering from the fallout of the past couple of years of turmoil. And remember, in 2011, there was the Tahrir Square Revolution, January 25th revolution, which toppled Hosni Mubarak, and then we saw the Muslim Brotherhood government that fell in the middle of 2013, and 6 months later they were still trying to stabilize the country after that. And so, you know, there was a lot of really interesting stuff that was going on. But in terms of what we've just been talking about, the kind of frontline reporting, it was relatively mundane. I expected to spend most of the time hanging around in a hotel, perhaps going out from time to time to interviews and protests. But it was largely a political story. And so I didn't think it was particularly serious or dramatic in any sense. And as I said, by the standards of the usual work that we'd been doing, it was pretty mundane.
And so before we move on, we've had you in Afghanistan under a tank, and now you're in Cairo. You're not that worried. What's your CV showing me about where you've been?
From Afghanistan, I had a year in Yugoslavia in 1996, at the end of the Balkans War, and then to the UK for the BBC for a few years working on their version of News 24. And then Latin America for 5 years and back to Africa I think it was about 2003, 2004. And I've been in it basically working across Africa ever since. Occasional forays into the Middle East and back to Afghanistan.
So all through the Middle East, all through Africa,
yeah.
As well as reporting
yeah.
in Europe. So the next time we see you, and we see you over and over again in that white jumpsuit, being led to and from court, mainly smiling. But there was one picture, and the listener can Google it, where you're in a cage and your hands are up on the wire of the cage, and you're looking out, and there's just a contained fury on your face.
Yeah. You know, it was funny, that period was always difficult for us. You know, it was going through a whole range of emotions from amusement at just the craziness of what we were going through, just how surreal it all seemed, and staring out at the gathered press corps and the lawyers through that cage was always a bit of a weird feeling. You know, you really did feel a bit like a caged animal, which I guess was the whole point of that cage. But I was also just angry at the craziness that had put us there in the first place, at the ridiculous ideas from the prosecution that had put us there, the ridiculous allegations, and the increasing frustration at not being able to challenge them. We couldn't understand why they couldn't see what to everybody else seemed blindingly obvious, and that was that there was absolutely no evidence that we'd done anything that we were accused of.
Mm. At the very minor end, exasperating.
Yeah, exasperation, frustration. But I also felt, and let's come back to what we were talking about right at the very beginning, that this wasn't so much about anything we had done at a personal level, but as it was about the institution of press freedom. And so I never really took it personally. I didn't think that this was really about me. I thought it was about press freedom. And so the frustration really was at not being able to make any progress on that front. I felt that, okay, we're being held as proxies for journalists everywhere, any journalist that wanted to operate in Egypt. And so it was important for me to hold on to my fury and recognize it for what it was, and not, as I said, not take it personally, not get angry at what was happening to me so much as what we were representing.
You gave a speech last week at the University of New South Wales, Journalism in the Age of Terror, and you describe going back to your cell with fellow Muslim prisoners after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, in which a magazine was targeted by Islamic extremists. There was a lively debate in that cell about freedom of speech and freedom of the press.
Yeah.
Take me through it.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess inside the cell we were having the same sort of arguments that a lot of people outside were having, and that's whether or not Charlie Hebdo had overstepped the mark in publishing magazines that depicted the Prophet Muhammad in ways that Muslims felt were quite insulting. And as far as a lot of the extremists, the Muslims, not even the extremists, but a lot of the Muslims that I shared the cell with were concerned, even though they felt that the actions of the attackers were extreme, were way beyond anything that was reasonable, they still felt that Charlie Hebdo had it coming, that in some sense, by insulting Islam,
they got
what they deserved, exactly. And I felt, look, that's ridiculous. I said, look, you have been insulted, but you can't legislate against an insult. You've got to be grown up enough to step outside the politics of the playground and accept that someone has made a criticism of your beliefs and maybe even insulted them. But you can't legislate against that without losing something more fundamental, and that is the right to criticise, to unpick, to challenge, to question.
And surely that's the reason that you and they were in that cell.
Yeah, exactly, which is precisely why we're in the cell. And that's why I felt that it was, you know, it was completely wrong to criticise Charlie Hebdo.
Did you win the day with that argument?
At the time, I felt I did.
Maybe they just wanted you to be quiet.
Maybe they did want me to shut up for a bit, yes.
You wrote in the speech, and I think this is interesting, it's a war, the war on terror, in inverted commas, it's a war between Western liberal democratic ideas and a particular branch of radical political Islam. And in that war of ideas, the battleground extends to the place where ideas themselves are prosecuted. In other words, the media. So journalists are no longer simply witnesses to the struggle. We are, by definition, the means by which the war itself is waged. Great analysis of what's going on. How does that change how journalists need to operate, do you think, or reinforce how they need to operate?
I think reinforce is the operative word. The traditional role of the journalist has always been to remain separate from the authorities, to remain above the political fray, to remain sceptical. And the problem is that we're under enormous political and social pressure to line up behind the what's often seen as a patriotic duty to conform to popular opinion, to the public, to political pressure, to attacks on Islam and Islamic extremism. But I think the opposite is true, that by abrogating our responsibility to remain sceptical, to challenge and question everything we're told, we actually give up our patriotic duty, because we have a responsibility to ask the difficult questions, to hold our politicians to account. And if we walk away from that, then I think we're losing something very fundamental about our democracy and the way democracy works.
You make a really fascinating argument. You know, after this last Paris attack, Le Parisien's headline, "This time it's war." Le Figaro's headline was "War in the heart of Paris." This happened in their city, Peter. What's wrong with those headlines?
Well, because what it does is that it adopts the mindset of war. The problem is that there are a whole raft of a whole series of ways that you could understand the attacks, either as a military attack on a state, or you could see it perhaps as a criminal assault, as a crime of mass murder. If you use the rhetoric of war, what it does is that it locks you in to the mindset of war. It means that you adopt the tools of war.
Isn't it a war?
Well, it can. You could consider it that way, but you could also consider it to be, as I said, a crime of mass murder, in which case you bring to play a whole range of other options, like detectives, like security analysis. You have a whole range of other tools that you can use. It's not always obvious, even though we talk about war and it might feel like a war, it's not always obvious that the best way to deal with the problem is to bring in tanks and special forces and so on, because they aren't necessarily best equipped to get to the bottom of what is a very complex, messy problem of internal security. And frankly, I think in a lot of ways it can be regarded as a crime. And so if we as journalists keep adopting the rhetoric of war, what we do is bring in a whole range of social attitudes that come with war as well. Ideas around heroism, around security, around sacrifice, and so on. Politicians like using the rhetoric of war, because it makes them seem strong and decisive. It makes them look as though they know what they're doing. They're going to do something to protect us, to prosecute a war.
Right now, in the heat of the moment.
Exactly. We send the tanks in. Mm. We send the troops in to Syria. And I'm frankly not entirely sure how sending extra troops or tanks or drone strikes in Syria would have stopped the attacks in Paris. It's not an option or shouldn't be an option. What I'm arguing is that as a journalist, if we immediately adopt the language of war, if we parrot that rhetoric that politicians keep using, all of a sudden we lock ourselves and our audiences, our readers, into a particular mindset of war. And we therefore shut out all of these other alternatives.
You make the point that the BBC handbook says don't say terrorist. Let your interviewee say terrorist, but don't you say terrorist. Don't you make that judgment. And then I thought you made a very powerful argument when you said, okay, the Russians attacked, quote, Islamic State positions. Pretty routine public statement they made, Islamic State positions. What's wrong with reporting that verbatim? That's a great example. What's wrong with that?
Islamic State positions as a phrase carries with it what we think is fairly clear-cut, idea. You know, and the word Islamic State positions conjures up a whole range of images, perhaps a checkpoint on a road or a command post with a machine gun outside and sandbag bunkers and all of that kind of stuff. When in fact anyone who's worked in the region would well understand that an Islamic State position is probably something like a mosque where a surveillance drone has seen men with guns walking in and out of, but is also quite probably something like a medical centre, or it could be simply a house in the middle of a village where people have been meeting. It could be a supply depot for fuel, which is used by local farmers and in the middle of a marketplace. And inevitably, unless we understand the detail of what an Islamic State position really is, we make all sorts of assumptions which actually hide more than they reveal. Mm. And the role of a responsible journalist is to step aside from that rhetoric, is to ask what on earth an Islamic State position really is, what's being hit, and what are the consequences of those kinds of attacks. Again, let me make it absolutely clear, Ellen, I'm not saying that it's wrong to hit an Islamic State position. I'm saying that the role of us as journalists is to stand back and ask the questions. What does it mean? What is the language that we're parroting? Hide. How do we dig down to get to the truth of what's really going on?
It's wonderful to have you standing in front of me a year on. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks very much, Ellen.
Peter Grister, doing amazing work, and the speech that he gave to the University of New South Wales, Journalism in the Age of Terror. We'll have a transcript up on our website. All throughout the program today, we're remembering 200 years of Jane Austen's Emma and digging out little quotes that resonate today. So our next story is about the families of fly-in, fly-out workers, those 80,000 hard-working Aussies, mainly blokes in high-vis vests, who inhabit a landscape of dongers and dust. It's just about as far as you could get from Austen's English village, I'd think. It seems everyone else has an opinion about these family arrangements. Ooh, that's a big sacrifice for the money. How are the kids getting on without a father? That sort of thing. So here is our Austen quote. Nobody who has not been in the interior of a family can say what the difficulties of any individual of that family may be. Quite so. So let's ask Debbie Russo, whose husband works on oil rigs 1 month on, 1 month off. She has a blog called The FIFO Wife, and she joins me from an avocado field in regional Queensland. No, you're at home. Good morning, Debbie. The weather caught you in.
It did. Thankfully, I was, avocado picking's hard work.
Thank you so much for coming on. I know that you don't often make media appearances, so national radio, just relax, Debbie. It's fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Your husband's been working offshore for 15 years now on oil rigs. Can you mm-hmm. describe to me the difference in those 2 months, the one when he's home and the one when he's not?
The one when he's at work, I guess, it's just full on routine. We have something going every day just to make sure that the days go by quickly and everyone stays in order. But when he's home, it's not too much different. He just slots into our routine. We probably get a bit lax on the weekends in terms of bedtime and that sort of thing.
So you've got three boys. What ages are they?
My three boys are 10, 8 and 6.
Okay. And so when he's home, everybody's bedtime drifts a little bit. The discipline reduces, does it?
No. He's a bit harder than I am.
I see.
I don't know. It just seems to... We go out more probably is probably the other thing. We have a tendency to... getting three kids into the car can be a little bit hard sometimes, so sometimes I don't make the effort I should on the weekend, but when we're home, there's an extra set of hands, so yeah, getting everyone into the car and out and about is much easier. So we probably are a bit more out and about and social. It's probably the main difference.
You write on your blog, people say, how do you cope? And you, I noticed you said on your blog, look, I'm happy to teach the kids how to put a worm on a hook and teach them to fish. Do you feel like you're well able to do this because of who you are?
Yeah, there's no reason why I can't teach them as the same as the blokey stuff, I guess you could say, as compared to what he would. I think I was very fortunate. I had a very good teacher. My mother was also in a similar situation to I, and there's nothing that I can't do. It's only what I won't do. So I'm willing to give anything a try, and baiting hooks or teaching them how to scooter is amongst them, then I'll do it. There's nothing I can't do. So you're
equipped to do it. He wants to do it. Why did you, when the kids came along, decide to keep doing it?
We just thought we'd see how it goes, and we just went from there, and we review it regularly, as in the lifestyle. And it's actually now the kids that determine whether he goes back to work to each contract and to whether that he doesn't. And so far the kids are all on board. We have had him work locally for a period of time, and they didn't really like it.
Really? They didn't like having him around all the time?
No, it wasn't that. He was having to go to work at 6 a.m. and he wasn't getting home till 5 p.m. He was working 6 days a week, and he wasn't able to go to class reading. He wasn't able to go to swimming lessons or basketball. He wasn't able to put in the time that he does when he is home for that month into them. You know, when he was working locally, there was no quality time whatsoever, and he was tired. So, yeah.
So that's interesting. For you and your family, it's not just about the money then?
No. It's, at one stage, I will be honest, it was about the money, but it's moved on from that, and we're very fortunate. We've been clever and worked very hard, but it is no longer about the money. It is about the quality of time that we get when he comes home. Because when he's home, he's home. He's not at work.
He's with you the whole month.
Yeah.
I was amazed to read on your blog how judgmental people are. What do they say to you?
It's more or less that we're greedy and it's about the money, and that we aren't really a family, or we have a part-time marriage, and, you know, when the kids were little, I would often get comments that we were doing a disservice to my children, which when you're sleep deprived and it is already hard, and those sorts of comments make things very, very hard. So people can be unintentionally mean. So, yeah, but there is a lot of judgment that you deal with, I think. But it's part of the territory, I suppose.
And there's a lot of poor you. Poor you, Debbie.
Yeah, that's probably the what I hate the most is pity. We make this as an informed judgment, and we're, you know, this is a decision that we made. We don't need pity, and I don't like it. I think it's terrible. It doesn't do well for me. It makes me quite cranky.
You give a lovely description. You're very honest on your blog about the drop-off. Despite all the positives when your husband's home, when you drop him back to the airport, you say that can be a killer. What happens?
Particularly when my kids were little, you always second guess yourself that you're doing the right thing, especially. But they still do it now. I think it's just to show how much they love him and that we do miss him. But they'll hang out the window and scream, "I love you," until he until he's no longer visible. It's it can be, yeah, quite hard. But you get home and you get into routine, and before you know it, the month is up and we're home picking him up and everyone's ecstatic. So.
You're getting emotional, I can hear, thinking about your kids doing that, aren't you?
I am. It's it was a hard period, but again, it's their their choice. It's always been their choice because they're well aware, having now experienced that that civilian life. I call it civilian life that we could exist with. They don't want to go there. But we did live. My husband and I were defence at one stage, and
he was in the Navy.
Yes, and I wouldn't. I grow from that because if other families can live a defence lifestyle, and 1 year he was home for 66 nights, other women, other ladies on board or families, they had families, and I was probably the only one without a family. And 1 year we tallied it up, he was home 66 nights, so there are always someone in a worse position than ourselves.
How alert are you to any signs of depression in your husband or the kids, or separation anxiety on either side, or any other mental health issue in those four men of yours, the three boys and your husband?
I think as they get older, increasingly so. I don't want our decision to affect them adversely. And particularly with my husband, he has to be happy, as well as my children. But he's the one that's at work without us in unfamiliar surroundings. So he has to be the main priority. So we always have to make sure that he's okay. That regular communication is the only way to make sure that you keep that at bay.
How do you ensure he's okay when he's away?
Just talking to him. We don't always get regular communication, so when he does ring, we just have to really be honest with each other and make sure that, you know, that when I say to him, "Are you okay?" that he's being honest with me, because I can only rely on his honesty.
Yeah. You were talking about revisiting this arrangement, whether it's working or not, for the family on your husband's 41st birthday. Now, that's coming up. Next year. What are your thoughts? Are you going to stay with the FIFO life?
I have a feeling we probably will at this stage, and we'll revisit it when my eldest boy has gone to high school. It suits well. Financially, we will be fine to finish up next year, and he could come home. But to be honest, the kids are happy. We're happy. And like I said, if I have a feeling we'll keep going with it. We might take a break, but I can't imagine it at this stage. And it will come down to how my eldest boy goes with high school. We'll just see how he goes with high school.
Year to year. Thank you so much for taking us through the details of your life. It's really fascinating to hear how you put it together. And, I mean, the prospect of having the other parent there 24 hours a day for an entire month, that's very enticing, Debbie, very enticing. I think you're getting me over the line there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Debbie Russo, she talks about her life on her blog, thefifowife.com.au. Look, you might have some insights to add. Join us on Facebook at RN Life Matters, or our listener line. You know we listen to it every day, 02-833-1430. 02-833-1430. Next, we have on the line a recovering FIFO worker, a comedian, Xavier Toby. He's just released his second book about the experience, called Going Out of My Mind. Get it? M-I-N-E-D. Very funny, Toby. It is a very funny book, but it also manages to deal with the dark side of life, of the FIFO life. There were 12 suicides in just 1 year in WA, and a parliamentary inquiry is finding these workers are significantly at a higher risk of depression than the wider community. Xavier, how did a comedian end up in a mining camp?
Well, for the main reason that a comedian goes anywhere, money. Really? Yeah, that's exactly right. I was flat broke and had some massive credit card debts. And luckily, I have a background that includes engineering, which my parents were spectacularly happy that I gave up on.
Yes, and, they were thrilled, weren't they?
Yeah, thrilled.
Terrific.
So I was able to get not a high-level job, but just a job in admin out there.
So where did you go and what did you do?
I was working, so it was a bit of a confusing one. I was actually in Queensland, a publisher for the books in WA, and I've done a lot of touring in WA since then. And anyone who's been on a FIFO site will tell you a lot of them are exactly the same with the dongas and the camps. But I was on a coal mining site at Murrumbar.
And what was your, they call it the swing. How long did you work and then how long did you have off?
I had 3 weeks on, 1 week off.
Only 1 week off. And yep. Where did you spend the 1 week off?
For a lot of the guys I was working with, they'd go home to their families, but I often went off to do comedy gigs or festivals around the place and sort of kept it a secret what I was doing. So I'd turn up maybe at the Adelaide Fringe and perform there for a week, and then I'd fly back out to site again.
Tell us what, how hard was that, three on, one off?
It's pretty exhausting. And that is, like, my cousin works at Port Hedland and he does the month on, month off thing, and he's got a family as well. And, it was similar to was it Julie that we just spoke to?
Debbie, sorry.
Similar to her experience. Like, he finds it quite good. But the guys I was working with the week off instead, like, you know, it takes you a day of travel to get there and a day of travel back. So you're down to 5 days, and it's not enough time to get into the swing of things back home.
How did you know that? What did they tell you?
Part of my job was also, so with the book, it's a little bit about my experience, but it's a lot about, because I've got a journalism background as well, like asking a lot of questions of the people I was working with and talking to a lot of different people about their experiences. I mean, I was only out there for 6 months. I know it's not really long enough to get a good sense of things, but I spoke to a lot of people to really get some first-hand knowledge of what was happening. And they were just saying that it's just really difficult. I mean, I was in the hiring as well, and a lot of people would come out and do one or two swings and then just disappear. And if I managed to catch up with them again, they would say, like, look, I just, you know, I feel like I'm completely missing out on my family's life. I just miss them too much, and then I get home, I feel like a stranger, and then before I'm even back in the swing of things, I'm gone again.
There was also a concern that you reflect that the downturn in the mining industry at present means a lot of people aren't willing to speak up if they're feeling depressed or mentally unwell.
That's to do with the way the hiring works as well. So if, just say you wanted a job in mining, right, and the company that I work for decided to give you a job, you have to go away because we were subcontractors. We have to ask the mining company, can we give this person a job? And they either say yes or no. And they don't give any explanation as to why that is. Like, your name might have made on some list for some reason, and no one's got any idea what happens there. So there's a worry that if you express some sort of mental health issue, your name goes onto some sort of list, and then you won't get a job again. And, like, that's probably not true, but no one knows whether it's true or not.
There's also routine drug testing. Are people worried that antidepressant medication will show up in that?
I didn't come across that, no. With the routine drug testing, from my experience, the workers were very adept at getting around that. So, I mean,
how do you mean?
I suppose I'm not there anymore. I can talk about all this sort of stuff.
Okay, go for it.
Like class A drugs, like cocaine, is out of your system really fast, and people know how many days they have to wait. People would stay away from things like marijuana because that stays in your system for a very long time. But then you have like the synthetic marijuana that wasn't getting picked up. And then things like acid, that's not picked up at all. So, you know, people knew what to take and when to take it. So, yeah, that wasn't really a problem.
And how much drug taking was there?
I never saw any. I never witnessed firsthand any drug taking on site. I mean, I know it does happen. I made it into the news, but I heard many times guys talking about how hard they hit it during their week away, and you know, some people owing people money for things that they bought and sold and all sorts of stuff.
Mm. You're living in New York now. That's a long way from Moranbah.
Yes.
Do you reckon you owe the FIFO life a creative debt?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as writers, I'm a writer and a comedian. We're always looking for inspiration. Personally, I don't find myself that interesting just as a human being. I think we're interesting for the things that we do and the experiences that we have. And going out there is sort of like, you know, traveling to a foreign country. I got to experience something that I wouldn't have otherwise experienced. It gave me a lot of inspiration. So, yeah, for sure.
It's an interesting book and a hard life, I think, Xavier.
It's a hard life, but That said, the other flip side of the experience that I think made it worth telling and you know, reading and writing about was how entertaining the guys are. Like, for all the stuff that's said about a hard life and maybe men aren't very good at sharing their emotions, they Australian men have some of the quickest and bluntest wits going around, especially to me as an outsider. There was certainly a lot of comedy. Just sit there and, yeah, just watch it all happen.
What's the best line anyone ever hit you with, finally?
That doesn't include swearing. That's going to be difficult. He's going to be, hang on, I'm trying to think of one that doesn't include swearing. There was just a lot of that brilliant sarcasm where it'd be like, oh, I've had a really hard day. And they just look at me and be like, you work in admin. And then they just walk off. And I just feel like, right, yeah, okay, fair enough. Yeah, you got me. Good.
Kept you on your toes, I bet. Thanks so much for being a guest.
No, no problem.
Xavier Toby has written two books about working FIFO near Moranbah in central Queensland. Now, finally, a conversation this morning with a fan and scholar of Jane Austen's Emma. Camilla Nelson is a senior lecturer in writing at the University of Notre Dame. She describes Emma as basically a teenage diva of a small English village, quote, desperately immature, frequently misguided, who meddles in the lives of characters around her, often to terrible effect. Jane Austen herself wrote, "I'm going to take a heroine whom no one but myself will much like." And you can imagine Austen chuckling as she wrote Emma with lines like this. Can you imagine her sitting down writing this? "Silly things do cease to be silly if they are done by sensible people in an impudent way." In other words, Camilla, if you're cheeky enough, you can get away with anything. Isn't that a great line?
Yeah, and I think Jane Austen got away with a lot.
Why does Emma endure? She is such a difficult young woman, isn't she?
Emma is a difficult young woman, but that's the point of the book. I think why people read and reread Emma is that it's a novel about finding a better way to live. It's a novel about becoming a better person. And Emma's a catastrophe.
Yes, there's a line that Austen writes, "Faultless in spite of her faults," is how her admirers see her. Faultless in spite of her faults.
And that's the wonderful Jane Austen voice, where you can hear, in a single line of Austen, you can hear the character, but you can also hear Austen commenting on the character. I mean, she has this wonderful new narrative style that we all take for granted today, because today that's how novels are written. But back in Jane Austen's old lifetime, it was a whole new form of language that she invented, where you could get really up close and personal with your characters in ways that hadn't really been seen before.
So when I read it at Christmas time, you inhabit Emma in a way that's very modern. We're used to writers writing like that. What was new about it precisely when Austen did it?
Austen invented a new kind of writing, and we call that free indirect style.
What does that mean?
It's a complicated term, but what it means, basically, before Austen, people narrated novels. In fact, novels like Defoe, they don't even have chapters. They just go on and on and on and on, and the author just tells you what's happening. With Austen, and there were innovations, but with Austen, we suddenly have realistic dialogue. We suddenly hear the thoughts of the characters. So it's the difference between something banal like, "I sat down and drank my coffee. I thought to myself, this is terrible." Mm. And then getting really up close, you know, "I drank my coffee. This is horrible. It's terrible." You know, you feel like the character is talking. I mean, that's a really banal example.
But then you overlay with that.
Yeah.
She's so funny. There's this wonderful line for anyone who hates, a surprise birthday party. This is a great line. "Surprises are foolish things. The pleasure is not enhanced and the inconvenience is often considerable." I mean, that's hilarious, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Jane Austen had something to say about everything, and she wrote about ordinary lives. At a time when literature was more, you know, Walter Scott with knights in shining armour going off to the Crusades, and it was all about men and male heroes, and Austen made women the centre, made women's lives the centre.
Now, she wasn't a major literary figure at the time. I mean, you're saying that she's writing this wonderful social work, but she's not in the middle of a literary circle, is she?
No,
she's kind of beavering away alone.
She lived in a small English village all her life, you know, other than sort of going to boarding school. She really never left the family circle. I mean, they were obviously, I mean, the first attempt to get her published was actually her father, who was an English vicar, wrote to a publisher and said, you know, publish Pride and Prejudice. And the publisher said no. Which is kind of like the worst mistakes in publishing history.
Yes.
But she was not in the mainstream. By and large, she had contact with other writers. She was reviewed by Walter Scott twice, for example. She once sent a copy of her book to Maria Edgeworth, and we don't know who Maria Edgeworth is today, but in that day she was famous. But very much, very, very much on the margins of the mainstream literary existence, which was, you know, Coleridge, Wordsworth, all of those people were around in the early 19th century.
So let's go to Emma, a very different sort of heroine. Heroines were supposed to be underdogs, you know, orphans and desperate women who needed saving. Emma was not. The only danger that Austen points out at the beginning of the book was intellectual solitude. That was her great danger that she describes.
Yeah, I think that one of a key virtue, and Jane Austen has very strong precepts. She's a very uncompromising moralist, but the kind of moral attributes she sees are things like friendship or amiability. And so one of Emma's problems is that she's too aloof. She has too much, what Austen would say, dignity, and she's not amiable.
She's a snob. But she's also very cruel. I mean, there's young Harriet, 19 years old, and she ruins a perfectly good marriage for Harriet and is terribly cruel to Harriet.
And I think that, it's one of the, you know, the tragedies of Emma. Emma learns from that. And because she learns, I think Austen allows Harriet and Emma to have a happy ending, because Harriet eventually does make a good marriage with her suitor, her original suitor. So when everyone learns to live correctly, according to the way Austen thinks we should, then they all get to have their happy endings.
Mm, despite the fact that she really is one of those cruel girls we all went to school with, who's rich and fabulous and marvellous and charismatic, but mean.
And I think that, you know, Emma, in terms of popularity, it was, and perhaps even still is, one of the least popular books, but the book that's most admired by scholars, which is kind of interesting. She is a heroine that, as Austen said, nobody but myself will much like.
Well, she was wrong about that 200 years on, 200 years since its publication this year, and still growing strong. And a wonderful book with lovely lines in it. And I think a bit of a feminist tract as well. Thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it.
Thanks, Ellen.
Camilla Nelson, Senior Lecturer in Writing at the University of Notre Dame. There is something about Emma. Tomorrow on the program, the glass trap door. That's the one older workers fall through. Successive treasurers tell us we'll have to work past the traditional retirement age. But what if no one will give us a proper job? One woman's tale of age discrimination, which sent her running for the hair dye.